and remember our good fortune at having healthy bodies and healthy, comparatively healthy minds. Our good fortune at having the wherewithal we need to be able to practice the Dharma and to have met teachers and teachings and a supportive community. Let's rejoice that we're even interested in the Buddha's teachings and have spiritual longing. So in our previous lives, we did a lot to create the causes for this precious human life. We can rejoice at that. And then looking to the future, think about how we want to use our present opportunity to create the causes for what we want to become in the future. So from the perspective of karma, if we want to have a good rebirth in the future, ethical discipline is the way to attain that. We want to have wealth and comfort. Being generous in this life is the method to bring that about. We want to be attractive in future lives. Cultivating patience now creates the karma for that. If we want to be able to complete the projects that we set out to and to attain the goals that we want in future lives, then generating joyous effort and acting with that now creates that cause. We want to be able to focus our mind and subdue the gross negative emotions in the future, then cultivating concentration and single-pointedness now will bring that about. And if we want to be wise, to be able to make good decisions, to be able to understand how things function and what their ultimate nature is, then the way to do that is through cultivating wisdom now. And of course, if we want to be well-loved and liked and appreciated in the future, the method to do that is to, at the moment, not follow our self-centered thought, but to cultivate a mind that genuinely cherishes others and wants to work for their benefit. So to learn all of this, we're going to listen to Dharma teachings. And our ultimate aim in this will be the full enlightenment of ourself and others through generating all of these good qualities. And the motivation is basically talking about cause and effect. I hope that came through. Yeah. So, you know, in science, we talk a lot about cause and effect and what causes what and what effects are brought about by what kind of causes. So we understand that, or we're coming to understand that through the efforts of scientific endeavors. But we also want to know about happiness and good qualities and what causes those. And it's not simply the dopamine and serotonin in our brain. not a thing of popping a pill or getting a shot. But when we look at the kind of good qualities that we admire and that we want to have, then we see that, you know, there's specific ways to cultivate them now through our actions. So this is the whole teaching on cause and effect or karma. Okay, and so, now, that's what I was explaining in the motivation. So, for example, the fact that we have a human body and a human mind with the intelligence and the capability of meeting the Dharma and practicing it and just having a, you know, a good rebirth in general, healthy body, for example, that comes through keeping good ethical discipline in the past, specifically not harming others. Because harming others creates the cause for sickness. Now, creates the cause for our body to be quite difficult or for an unfortunate rebirth. So when we look at it this way, we say, oh yeah, ethical discipline is very good. But when we think of what we have to do to keep ethical discipline, and that it actually means restraining from following some of our impulsive thoughts, then we don't like ethical discipline so much, you know? Like, what? I can't lie? I can't drink? Huh? You know? You're telling me not to use things that I can get to take things from my office and use them for my own personal benefit? You're telling me that's not good? But I do that all the time. Yeah? And so sometimes when it comes down to the practicalities, we cease believing in cause and effect in the long term, and we just believe in cause and effect about what we can get from the action in the short term. Okay? So similarly about generosity, when we talk from a karmic perspective, you know, why is it that we have wealth and live in one of the richest countries? It's because of having been generous in a previous life. If we want to have wealth and wherewithal in a future life, the way to do that is by being generous. So we say, oh yeah, generosity is very good. No? But then when it comes time for us to be generous, well, no, actually stinginess is the cause of wealth. You know, if I give things away, then I won't have them. This is what we think, isn't it? You know, on a day-to-day basis. Well, I really can't give that, and I can't give that, because then I won't have all these things, and then I'll be poor. So it's quite interesting how that works. You know, there's a disconnect between intellectually what we believe and practically how we act and what we really believe. You know, the intellectual belief in our head and how we act, which comes from in our heart. So similarly about having an attractive appearance, you can see how being patient, you know, and cultivating forgiveness and tolerance and so on would lead to having an attractive body, because, you know, when you're angry and you're, you know, your face is red and you're glaring and, you know, clearly you're not attractive then, and so, you know, an angersome person who's always, you know, having unattractive conduct then has an unattractive body in a future life. Okay, and we can understand that very well and say, oh yeah, patience is very good, and definitely people should be extremely patient with me. Yeah. They shouldn't get mad at me, because it's better for them not to get mad at me, then they'll create the, you know, the cause to have an attractive body. But on the other hand, when somebody does something we don't like, well, you know, I'm very entitled to get mad, because they made a mistake and I have to let them know, you know. And so then our whole thing about, you know, patience causing attractiveness, it's out the window, because, you know, what we perceive as some getting some benefit now, you know, the relief of telling somebody off, appears greater to us. So this happens over and over again, you know. Like, similarly with joyous effort, now we can all see how the difficulty we have in keeping commitments now and in finishing things that we start. We all have problems with that. And when we think in the future, boy, I'd like to be able to, you know, have accomplished things with joy, not with pushing myself, but with joy, and be able to carry things through to the end, especially, you know, beneficial projects. I want to be able to do that. Well, then the cause for that, you know, is by practicing joyous effort now. But then we think, oh, joyous effort? Well, actually, I want to sleep another few hours. And I can practice Dharma tomorrow in the morning. Yeah. And, you know, and so thus begins the wheels of procrastination. That bring us, those wheels don't turn. It's just at a standstill, you know. You know, like when you're trying to get across the railway tracks and the train stops in the middle and you can't cross them. Yeah, so that's the lack of joyous effort. Okay. So what I'm getting at is, in our way of thinking, to spend more time contemplating about the long-term results that we want to attain and what actions we do now that bring about those long-term results. And then start cultivating those actions now. And when the mind comes up that says, but, you know, I want to have this right now, and, you know, and when the mind starts looking at the short-term benefits of, let's say, you know, keeping something for ourselves or shouting at somebody or, you know, sleeping another few hours or putting off the work we have to do or whatever, instead of just following that mind, come back and remind ourselves, oh, if I do that, what kind of habit energy am I setting up for myself? What kind of karmic energy am I creating? And this is going to bring an actual result in the future. And do I want to experience the result that I'm creating the cause for right now? Okay? And if we stop and think like that, it can really help us, you know, look at the long-term result and thus be willing to work for the long-time term instead of just looking for what we can, our comfort in the moment. Okay, making some sense? Mm-hmm. Now we just have to remember to practice it. That's the hard part. It always makes sense, doesn't it? You know, Dharma isn't terribly difficult. It makes sense. We just forget to practice it. Okay. So, going back, I wanted to continue with some of the teachings, you know, from the Exploring the Monastic Life program, even though we have the broader community here today. And in those teachings, we've talked some of the history, and then we've also been talking about what are qualities of a monastic's mind, what kind of human qualities do we try and cultivate. And then we've also been talking about some of the main principles that the precepts, that, you know, the monastic precepts, what values those principles are coming, no, what values those precepts are stemming from. Okay? So I haven't been so much going through the detailed list of the precepts, but more what are the mental states and what is the kind of lifestyle that we're trying to create by living as monastics. And a lot of this has to do, I think, and can have some significance for the Buddhist community at large. So I think those of you who are visitors just for the day will find some benefit in this. Okay, so one of the qualities of a monastic lifestyle is simplicity. Okay, so the simplicity, that's something that, you know, is difficult nowadays, isn't it? We talk a lot about simplicity, but who has a simple life? Now, on a physical level, our lives are not very simple at all, you know. We have houses filled with stuff and cars filled with stuff, okay? So on a physical level, there's very little simplicity, yeah? On the level of time, there's very little simplicity. People seem to to be overwhelmed by the life that they've created. Okay, so, you know, I don't think we're doing so well on simplicity. Yeah? And that this is where a lot of the stress that people experience come from, you know, from having too many possessions and having to take care of them, or doing too many things that aren't of great value, and thus not having enough time to do the things that are important to us. And we have some fear of simplicity. Yeah, it's very interesting in talking about this topic with people. Somebody from Spokane came up the other day and is doing a newspaper article on the Abbey. It'll come out, I think, next week, Monday. Okay, so please buy the Spokane paper for us, okay? but it was interesting because when I was talking with her about the values of the Abbey, I mean, she was clearly very supportive. And when I was talking about simplicity and how, you know, we try and, you know, have a simple lifestyle, she was saying that she has a 2-year-old child and, you know, it's like time for the 2-year-old's birthday. And so then the thing is, oh, well, we've got to have a party. And they wanted to say, please don't bring gifts because their kid has everything they need to start with. But then she said that they were afraid as parents that if their kid doesn't get gifts, then because all the other kids get gifts on their birthday, then their kid's going to feel denied or, you know, or that the other kids are going to think that their kid's strange and things like that. And I thought that was so fascinating, you know, how people, it's the thing of I think they think I should think, isn't it? You know, what we think they think, you know, we should do. And how we're always projecting outward like that. How am I going to fit in with society? These people must think this, therefore I must do this. Because I've got to fit in with them. And therefore we make our lives tremendously complicated doing things that we don't even believe in or doing things we don't even want to do, you know, because we're so attached to what other people think about us, even though we haven't asked them. And even though they're far too self-centered to spend much time thinking about us because they're too busy thinking about themselves. But we're so self-centered that we think that other people have nothing better to think about than what they think of us. You know? But we can clearly see from our own mind, you know, take us for example, we're too busy thinking about ourselves. Other people, you know, they flash in and out of the mind like this. You know, we don't spend much time on thinking, you know, about what we think about others. And so similarly, they don't spend a whole lot of time thinking about what they think about us. Because if they did, they would certainly realize that we're the center of the universe and they would treat us better. You know, so that just shows how little time they spend thinking about us. Okay. True or not true? Okay. You know, so I think a lot of the complication we make in our life is we're so afraid. It's fear-based. You know, what are other people going to think about me? And so we become these incredible people pleasers, you know, and guessing what other people are going to think and then trying to become that without even asking them. Okay? And that's just a dead end. I mean, how can we live our lives trying to second-guess other people and what they think we should be? And anyway, even if we become what we think they think we should be, are we going to be happy? And is that honest? You know, I think that's a question of honesty. Because we spend a lot of our life trying to impress other people by what we have, what we do, making sure, you know, impress them that we fit in with this group, we have their values, we have their goals, we have the same kind of possessions that they do and do the same kinds of things. And we try and impress other people. And is that honest? Because if we do that, we may be good at it, and they may believe that we're a certain way. But then what we're doing is we're setting ourselves up for a lot of pain and misery afterwards, because we aren't really the way we're trying to impress them to think that we are. And so when they find out what we really are, and that we're not really interested in all the things that we've been talking like we're interested in order to impress them, then, you know, they're going to be very disappointed. And that's going to affect the relationship. I mean, think about it, and how often we do this with people. You know, we think, oh, this person, that, you know, they're going to like a person who is like this and this and this and this and this. So I like this person, so I better try and make myself like the person that I think they're going to like. So I do all these things, and I pretend I'm interested. They like golf, so I pretend I'm interested in golf. And, you know, they like, you know, shopping, so I'm going to pretend I'm interested in shopping. And they like race cars, so I'm going to, you know, get interested in race cars. And they like going out to the movies, so I'll go out to the movies with them. And we do all these things to win other people's approval and impress them. And then they, of course, think that we're marvelous, because maybe we happen to guess right about what we think they think we should think. And we did it right. And so then they think we're really marvelous. Yeah. And they fall in love with us, and they think we're really spectacular. And then as time goes on, I mean, if you're not really interested in golf, after a while it becomes hard to keep up that facade, doesn't it? You know? And if, you know, you're not really expressing your opinion, but you're hiding everything that you think in order to not to offend them, well, how long can you do that? After a while, you're going to start saying what you think. So then so what's happened is you've made this person like somebody who you aren't. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And then they find out who we are, and then they go, well, you know, you're not as good as I thought you were. And then we go, oh, my friend is leaving me. You know, I did so much for you. Yeah, we do this one. I did so much for you. You know, I went to golf games. I went race car driving. I went shopping. I did so much for you and sacrificed so much. And now you don't think I'm worthwhile. But, you know, we were being very deceptive all along, weren't we? You know, just out of our own attachment to winning approval, or, you know, wanting people to like us. So it's kind of a setup for our own pain. Yeah. And it's not really fair to the other person. Okay. So the antidote to that, you know, because we tend to be extremists. So the antidote to that is not just, oh, I'm going to be myself, and if I feel like screaming, I'm going to scream, and if I feel like throwing something, I'm going to throw it, because I really want them to know who I am. Well, you know, that's not so smart. You know, we need some basic human manners. We're trying to practice ethical discipline, you know. So, you know, we shouldn't go to the extreme of, okay, I'm just going to let it all hang out, because that's not very kind to other people, and that creates a ton of negative karma in the process of it. Okay? So I think, you know, that part of this complicated lifestyle we get ourselves into is coming from our own mind, and are wanting people to like us. Okay? But we don't see that. And so we say, I have to do this. And so some of you were here a couple of months ago when we had the all-day sit, and we had the discussion group about I have to. Yeah, do you remember that? It was quite interesting. And how we tell ourselves all the time, oh, I have to do this, and I have to do that. I have to go over to these people's house for dinner, and I have to go to work, and I have to work overtime, and I have to, you know, do this and that and the other thing for my kids. And like this lady, you know, I have to have a birthday party for my kids, and I have to, you know, let people bring presents. You know, because we think it's all coming from outside due to social pressure, what other people want, or how it's commonly done. But it's not. It's all coming from inside us and our wanting to fit in and wanting to be liked. Okay? So when we start noticing this, then we can really pull back and begin to make some wise decisions about what really is important to us and how we really want to live. And I think that's much more honest. And then instead of going through our life saying, I have to, and feeling resentful all the time, you know, we can really live the life that we want to live because we've thought about what is really valuable and important to us in our life. You know, so for example, what I said to her is I said, well, you know, I said, I think, you know, I support you in, when you send out the invitation saying, please don't bring gifts. And here's some other ideas, you know, if you don't feel comfortable with that, here's some other ideas. One is tell your child that, you know, people will bring gifts, but that he's going to have the great, wonderful opportunity to take them to children who don't have and share his things with other kids. And then when he gets the gifts, take him or her, I don't know if it was a boy or a girl, but take your child to the orphanage or the homeless shelter and have them give the gifts themselves so that they really see how other kids live. You know, so it's not just that other kids are some kind of abstract idea and you don't want your child to be exposed to that, so you put it in the car and leave it on the doorstep of the homeless shelter. But you actually go there and give it, and your child sees and has the pleasure of seeing real human beings who are going to get that. So I said, that's one way you could do it. Or another way is tell people that instead of giving gifts, to make a monetary gift to a charity, and then to get a card or a letter or a receipt from that, and then in your child's room make a huge mural or a collage, that's the word, a collage with all the receipts and cards and thank you letters from all the charities who have received gifts in the child's name. And I said, then your child really knows, look, wow, all these people care about me. Mm-hmm. And from my side, I care about others. And look at all these wonderful letters that we have. Okay? So I think there's many kind of ways to act, you know, so that we don't get into this have-to mind that just brings so much complication in our life. Okay? So, you know, simplicity of lifestyle, it's really, you know, this is one of the things that we're trying to do as monastics, and it can be very, very difficult. You know, if I'm going to talk about, like, on a physical level, you know, simplicity of lifestyle, it becomes hard. I think some of you know the story. I was telling it a few days ago that when I lived in Seattle, one person wanted to give me a television set, and I don't watch TV. I think it's boring, and I also don't want my mind conditioned by all the rubbish on the television. And, you know, I mean, they just really wanted to give me a TV. And I said, you know, please give the money to the Tibetan nuns or give it to a charity. You know, the Abbey didn't exist at that time. And the person didn't want to, and I just held to what I believed in. Because otherwise they give it, and I don't know what to do with the television, you know. Becomes problematic. So sometimes in a world where there's just so much, then, you know, it's hard to live simply because you get a lot of gifts from people. And then what do you do with the gifts? Well, then if you give them away, you feel guilty. So you put them in your closet, and they get moldy and mildewy, and then you throw them out. Does that make any sense? You know? And I think this whole thing, that the question came up, you know, earlier in our program, you know, somebody gives you a gift and then they, you know, they might ask you a few years later, are you using it, you know? And you've got to say yes or no. You could say it's in my closet, and you know, or I took it out and I used it once. You know, you could say yes, I used it because you opened the box and looked at it, you know, and then put it back in the closet. But you know, I think we also have to get over this whole thing that when somebody gives us a gift, there's some obligation to, you know, involve. But because if somebody's really giving, it no longer belongs to them, it belongs to us. And similarly, when we give a gift, it no longer belongs to us, it belongs to the other person. And they're a free agent to use it for whatever thing they see fit for. Yeah? Or if we want them to use it for a certain purpose, we should tell them. Like sometimes people make donations to the Abbey and they say it's for this program or for that reason, and then we use it for that. So we can do that with friends also. But, you know, this thing of, like, holding on to it, or this thing of, you know, if they wear what I gave them, that means they love me. Huh? What? I don't understand the logic in that. Yeah? But we think that, don't we? Oh, I gave them a scarf. If they don't wear the scarf, they don't love me. Is that true? That true? It's not true. Yeah? So, you know, I think gifts should be freely given. And if somebody gives us something and we return it, or we give it to a charity, you know, or we give it to somebody else, I think, you know, if somebody asks us afterwards, you know, how do you like it, I think we can be honest and we can say, you gave me that gift with a lot of love and I really appreciate that. Know? And I didn't need that specific item, and so with a lot of love, I gave it to somebody else. Because the basic thing when we give gifts is we're using a material possession to express affection. Yeah, and so it's what the important thing is, not whether we like the material object, but that we acknowledge that somebody was expressing their affection, and yes, we received that gift of their affection, which is the real important one, and that we acknowledge that and we appreciate that. Okay? So that's just a little bit about giving gifts, okay? Or receiving gifts. But let's talk a little bit more about this, the whole value part. That's a little bit the practical aspect of living simplicity. Let's talk about the value part. If we really value having a simple life, then we can't be bought off or guilt-tripped or bullied by somebody else. Okay? Because we have thought about the lifestyle that we want to live, and if somebody comes and, you know, guilt trips us because, you know, how can you not have this? You know, you've really got to have this. Or if somebody is applying social pressure on us, or if somebody is dangling in front of us, you know, oh, if you take this job, you get an extra $10,000. You know, we're not going to be influenced by that, because what's important in our mind is not the material possessions and the wealth, but the value we have of living a simple lifestyle. Okay? So that makes us much more clear in our life, and not we don't succumb to social pressure as much. And if our family is trying to bully us or guilt trip us into living a more complicated lifestyle than we want, we just aren't susceptible to it, you know. We don't feel defensive. We don't feel like, you know, guilty because we're not doing what they want us to do. But we just know what our own value is, and we value simplicity, and this is the way we're living. You know, and I think if you can bring kids up with that value, what an incredible way to educate a child. You know, to teach your child that they don't have to be swayed by peer pressure. You know, and if you're afraid of your kid getting into drugs when they're a teenager, teach them when they're little that they don't have to be swayed by peer pressure, that they can believe in something and hold on to their own value and not be pressured by what other people think. And live that as an adult yourself so that the kids see that modeled. You know? I mean, otherwise, you say, you know, people say to their kids, oh, you know, don't follow peer pressure. You know, say, you try saying that to a 14-year-old. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, don't do what everybody else is doing. And meanwhile, what are mom and dad doing? Mm-hmm. Everything what they think other people think they should do. Yeah. So as a monastic, what we're doing is we're pulling ourselves out of that. Okay. And saying, no, the simplicity is what we believe in. And you can come and say, we need this and that, or, you know, how can you blah, 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 or whatever. So as individuals and as a community, then, you know, we just say, well, yes, you may think that, but no, thank you. You know, we have a different lifestyle. So it gives you a lot of freedom in your mind. Another thing of living with simplicity is we let go of our preferences. Okay? And that's another thing that makes our life complicated, is we have so many preferences. What kind of Tupperware do you want? Do you want the ones with the blue covers or the ones with the red covers? Do you want the square ones or the round ones? You know, and then we get so involved in thinking about the advantages and disadvantages of all the different kinds of Tupperware. You know, and we could spend a whole meditation session on that. You know, and, you know, forget what's happening in Iraq, forget our future lives, forget enlightenment. You know, we're single-pointedly trying to eke out the most bliss from the Tupperware that we can. Okay? When you have a simple lifestyle, You stop caring about the color of lids of your Tupperware, the roundness or squareness of your Tupperware. You know, I mean, this is a gross example, but we have lots of things like this. Okay? So it's like, you know, you need a blanket, you get a blanket. It doesn't matter whether it's, you know, red or purple or blue or, you know, if it has the exact kind of texture that you want and the exact kind of shape that you want, you know, you get something that works. And it doesn't have to be exactly like your preconceived, you know, image of the perfect object. Okay? And especially those of us here at the Abbey, you know, a lot of what we use to live is stuff that's donated to us. And so I think that's a very good practice for us. Because sometimes what people donate isn't exactly what we need, but we use it anyway, okay? There are certain situations where people say, what do you need? And then we do some research and we say, this works better. You know, we just got a grizzly cot, you know? And so it's the cot that the people are going to be sleeping on in the winter because we don't have enough beds, okay? So we tested it out, and, you know, so we said, what do you need, you know? Well, this will do, you know? So in that kind of situation, we let people know. But then other people have donated beds, and the beds aren't necessarily the size or shape that, you know, that fit in the bedrooms the best or that, you know, but we use them. We use them. So we use what we have. And so it helps us in terms of our own training to let go of preferences. Okay? And so this goes a lot with the food, you know, and you really see this once you've lived in a communal situation for a while. At the beginning, it's very difficult in terms of food because we all have our preferences. I like this and I don't like this and there should be more of this and, you know, and it can become very hard in a communal situation because you have all your preferences of what you eat. And then, you know, you have to work with your mind because, you know, everybody's just not going to cook exactly the way you like it and to your own preferences and what you like. And so then you work with your own mind. And so, like, I've lived in communal situations for quite a while, and you have too, and you just get used to whatever there is, you eat it. And what's really funny is then when people invite you out to eat and you go to a restaurant and they give you a menu and you have to choose, I can't choose, you know. And I look and I find it fascinating at restaurants. This is a very good study in people. And I've always thought it would make a great PhD dissertation. How much, because it tells a lot about how the human mind operates. How much time people spend choosing what kind of food they're going to have when they go out to eat. Yeah. Here we have a precious human rebirth with the possibility to realize the ultimate nature of reality and generate love and compassion equally for all sentient beings. You know, we have the body and mind that can, you know, is the basis for that kind of realization. And what do? We'll spend 15 or 20 minutes discussing all the dishes on the menu. Yeah? Have you noticed? Maybe you haven't because you've been so involved in the interesting discussion of what's the difference between this dish and that dish? And, you know, this dish and that. And does this one have a side dish? Then this one come with salad and soup? And what kind of dressing on the salad and, you know, and what kind of soup, and does the soup, do you chop your green peppers in big pieces or small pieces? Because I only want soup with green peppers in big pieces. And, you know, spending so much time choosing the kind of food. It's incredible. And then it comes, and it's gone. You eat it, and it's gone. And a day later, you probably can't even remember what you ate. Yeah? Okay, so we are very trained in this consumer culture to have lots and lots of preferences and be very picky. And this actually creates a lot of mental difficulty, you know, because unless you get exactly what you want, you're going to be unhappy. So it's a setup for unhappiness. And then also, we spend so much time trying to figure out exactly what it is that we want. Yeah. So when people invite me out to eat, I usually say to them, you know, pick something because I can't decide. And as long as it's vegetarian, and I give them my eating requirements because that accord with my vows, and then, you know, pick something. Okay. So I think it's a very interesting mental training to sometimes let go of our preferences. And again, this is something that happens in communal living, that the Chinese monastics really take this to an extreme. So when you ordain there, you might be living in a dorm room of, you know, maybe 6 people or 8 people. All your beds look alike. When you go into that room, they usually don't let other people go into the monastics rooms, but because I was monastic and because I did some of my training there, I saw. All the beds look exactly alike, okay? Because you have to fold, everybody folds their quilts in exactly the same way, and everybody has exactly the same quilts, okay? So your bedding is exactly the same. You fold it in the same way. It's piled up at the same, everybody puts it at the same end of their bed, and you can't tell one bed from another. Your clothes, there's cupboards in the wall, either cupboards or drawers, okay? And you're all wearing the same clothes because you're monastic, so there's no individuality there. And the same shoes, you know, same clothes, same shoes. You all have the exact same number of cupboards. You have to fold your clothes in a certain way. And you put them in the cupboards, and the cupboards are closed, okay? So us, and because we really like our individuality, don't we? We want a blanket that's like this, and we want the bed made like that, and we want our little picture of the people we love all surrounded our bed, you know, all of our objects of attachment, and all our little tchotchkes, memorabilia, you know, all the little knickknacks and objects. Here's from when we went to Coeur d'Alene, and here's from when we went to, you know, this place. And we decorate You know, I mean, what is our house? It's an exposition of who we are, isn't it? You know, and the pictures that people were attached to, places were attached to, objects were attached to, all about me and our individuality. Okay? So it's quite interesting, you know, in a Chinese monastery, because that's gone. Yeah? And all these preferences and all this thing about look at me, look at me. And, you have your room, but you share rooms, and, you know, people don't have knickknacks, yeah? We don't have knickknacks. We don't put up pictures of our dear ones and the objects of our attachment. Our spiritual teachers and the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are quite different, but, you know, our relatives and friends and all of this, you know, and souvenirs and stuff like that. That's got to go. We still kind of, it's quite interesting, and as the monastery progresses, this is going to change, because we start bringing things from home when you first come to the abbey. You bring things from home, so you have your favorite comforter and your favorite this and your favorite that. But, you know, as time goes on, then when those things wear out, then we use what has been offered to the abbey in general. Okay, we don't go out shopping as a monastic. I mean, what lay people do is one thing, but what monastics at the abbey do is another, is we don't go out and buy exactly the kind of whatever it is that we want. We see what's in the storeroom that's there that fits the practicality of what we need, and we use that. Okay, so it helps us get over this whole thing of having so many preferences and opinions, you know. So we start to close down the opinion factory. Mm-hmm. And I tell you, wearing the same clothes all the time is a great gift in that way. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have to think about what you wear and if it's appropriate for the situation, if they've seen you wear that before, you know, because yes, they have. And they'll see you wear it again. Okay, you just don't have to think about any of that, yeah? So it frees up the mind to think about more important things than creating our identity through our possessions. Another benefit of simplicity is that we conserve the earth's resources. And I think this is a very important one, and it's an expression of compassion, yeah? So on one hand, we're trying to create compassion in our meditations because we can really see the value of compassion in life. But we've got to live compassion in our life too, not just meditate on it. Okay. So if we're going to live compassion, then we've got to think of the future generations that are going to inhabit this planet. And if I get in a car and I don't carpool, and I drive my own car simply because I want to be alone, is that an act of compassion on my part for the future generations? Now, we might say, oh, well, you know, look at all the other people. They're doing it too. And, you know, it doesn't really make a big difference. So, you know, my carpooling isn't going to, you know, stop all the ozone, you know, depletion, blah, blah, blah. But the fact is that, you know, why is the climate changing? Because each of us as individuals are doing it. So each of us as individuals has to take responsibility for living our compassion in terms of how we use resources. Okay? So similarly, you know, do we take our plastic bags back to the grocery store and reuse them? Do we take our paper bags back to the grocery store and reuse them, or bring cloth bags? Yeah, here at the Abbey, we save all of our plastic and paper bags, and they all get given to some people who have sell vegetables in the summer, so that they can use them for their stuff. Okay, but do we really pay attention to stuff like that and reuse? Or if we're only getting one item at a store, do we say, don't bother giving me a bag? Okay? When we get in a car, do we think about where we're going and if we really need to go there? Or do we just get in the car to have a drive, you know, and have a good time? And do we take time to structure and plan how we do our errands? Because I think this is another element why people feel that they don't have any time, is because they don't plan their errands very well. So they drive to this end of the city on Monday to do this, and that end on Tuesday to that, and back to the third place on Wednesday to do something else, and back to the place they were on Tuesday, they go again on Thursday because they thought of something else. Whereas if we really sit and think about, you know, what is it that I need to do or in certain places and plan it out, we conserve gas, which is an incredible expression of compassion for future generations, and we conserve a lot of time. Yeah, and so then we have more time for our spiritual practice or more time for our volunteer work because we're not so busy just riding in the car, you know, oh, I forgot bread, got to go out and get bread. Well, that takes a half an hour, doesn't it? Oh, next day, forgot butter, got to go out and get butter. That takes another half an hour. Yeah. So, you know, that's part of what we try and practice here at the Abbey. And I can see it's a real struggle sometimes for people when they first move here because we are so used to, I need something, I want something, get in the car and go get it. You know. Now, of course, sometimes when you're building, it's impossible. You know, you do your best to, like, try and figure out how many nails and how much sheetrock and, you know, all of this. And you do your best to plan, but there's always things that come up at the last moment. So you try and at least do one trip, you know, instead of like a two or three trips a day to get each thing that you need that you forgot when you're building. But in, you know, and you do that, don't you? Yeah? But you did. I mean, this since the beginning of the program, I think there's only been one trip to town, you know, or possibly two, you know, but not a lot.
No.
Yeah. So definitely getting better. But you can see really, you know, that people just on the personal level when they come here so used to the mind of, oh, I need some new hand lotion. I don't like the hand lotion that's available at the Abbey and I forgot mine, I need to go out and buy hand lotion. As if, you know, it's gonna be tremendous, drastic suffering to use a kind of hand lotion you don't like. Or that you've never even used before, or to not use your favorite hand lotion, you know. So you see how these things fit into, you know, like the thing of the hand lotion, you know, working with the mind. It says, oh, you know, everything has to be exactly as I want it. And then, so that helps us cut down on compassion. And then because we don't run out to the store all the time getting what we want, it cuts down on the gas money, and that's the expression of our compassion. Did I say it cuts down on compassion or it cuts down on attachment? And nobody blinked an eye and said anything? Hello? You need to correct me when I make mistakes. Huh? So, you know, it helps cut down on attachment. Yeah, right? Okay. But, you know, it's definitely part of our training. Yeah. And so simplicity, too, it means not filling up your cupboards with what you have that you don't use. And, you know, I can see the difficulty in lay life with that. I mean, cupboards are just filled with stuff, and yet people can't give it away. When I was teaching in Seattle, we were talking about this, so I gave people a homework assignment that they had to, between, you know, this week and next week, clean out just one cupboard or drawer. I didn't even ask the whole house, but I said, just one, you know, and then come back next week and say what it was like. And, you know, clean it out and then take it to a charity and give it, because somebody else can use it. So it was very interesting what happened the next week. You know, somebody came back and said, I was cleaning it out and, you know, and I came across all this T-shirt that I had gotten in Mexico 10 years ago that I had forgotten I had, but it reminded me so much of that wonderful Mexican holiday But I really couldn't bring myself to give it away. You know? It was something they had even forgotten they had. Yeah? And it was, people were quite honest, you know? And somebody else, you know, was, oh, I was too busy, I couldn't do it. So you know what kind of mind that's coming from. You know, the I'm too busy, I can't do it, it means I don't want to do it. Then somebody else said, well, I cleaned it out, and it got, the box got as far as the front door, and it's still there. And somebody else, their box got in the trunk of their car, but it didn't get to the charity, you know. It was so fascinating. And, of course, we were all roaring with laughter as we were seeing what was going on in our own mind, you know, and how we couldn't even give away things that we had forgotten we had and never used. Yeah. Look at that mind of attachment. What is going to happen when we die? You know, everybody thinks, oh, I'm not attached, I'm going to die and go off smoothly. If we can't give away, while we're alive and healthy and our mind is calm and peaceful, something that we forgot we had that we never use, how are we going to separate from all our possessions at the time of death? When there's no choice. Think about it. You know, if we have that much attachment to one thing, what's going to happen at death time when, bye-bye, you know? So you see, simplicity in life is also making for simplicity at the time of death and ease at the time of death, because it's really helping us to train the mind in letting go of attachment, you know, very, very much. Okay, so letting go of attachment is one advantage. Conserving the earth's resources as an expression of our compassion is an advantage. Another thing that lies behind the simplicity of lifestyle is an experience of our interconnectedness. Okay? That the things that we have were given to us by others. Yeah. And here there's going to be a difference between a lay life and a monastic life. Because a lay life, you want something, you go out and get it. Okay, but I'm advocating restraint even in that aspect for a lay practitioner. But in a monastery, like I was just saying, you don't, oh, we need this, we want this, we go out and get it. Yeah, but we... You know, if there might be something we, like we were talking this morning, you know, there's going to be need for a freezer. We're not getting in the store and going out and buying it Monday morning. It goes on our wish list, and maybe sometime in the next few months people will give it to us. Or maybe they won't, okay? But it influences your mind when there's some, when we're just not acting on every impulse that's going on. And then when we do get something, there's an incredible feeling of interconnectedness. And so you see, like on the wish list that's on our website, we write down, you know, the names of people, unless they ask to remain anonymous, who have given us the things. And it's incredible, you know, to look down this list and see, you know, where everything came from. And you just even look in this meditation hall of who gave us different things. Okay? I mean, Pete gave the clock, and the Chinese nuns gave this, and Sinan and Weiling in Singapore gave this, and Aida made this, and the Chinese nuns, people in Singapore gave this one as well. Okay? Eric, our architect, gave the tables. And the cushions were purchased by the FOSA, Friends of Shravasi Abbey, had done a collection to furnish the meditation hall, so that was given by quite a number of people, you know. And as you start to look around, you know, so many of the items we have were donated by others. So you really feel the interconnectedness. And our whole kitchen, you know, was... by donation. Yeah? I mean, I'm not sure if we even bought anything in the kitchen or not, or if it was all, you know, donation by one person or another. you know, and Alice, you know, at the beginning, furnished the whole kitchen. Did you furnish a kitchen? I don't know, but filled the cupboards and, you know, dishes, and Tracy brought stuff, and, you know, many people. And then subsequent to that, you know, you need a rice cooker. Well, the people in San Jose gave a rice cooker, and, you know, some people in Tacoma sent the frying pan. And, I mean, a lot of the things in the house I can go through, and I can tell you exactly who gave them. And you feel this tremendous sense of interconnectedness with the people, and the incredible sense of kindness of people, and how our lives are interwoven. And we're not just independent beings. And especially living a monastic lifestyle, you know, you wait, you know, until things are given, and then you feel the gratitude for what you receive. And it's quite amazing, you know, when you do this. And you just feel so interconnected, you know. I mean, during this whole monastic program that we've had, Barb's been going out and doing grocery shopping. And so we think of, you know, all the people who offered the Dana to support this program, and of Barb going to all these stores and doing the shopping and, you know, doing the laundry and all sorts of things. So you really feel how we are not isolated, independent units, you know, and how much kindness we receive from other people. And I think this is something that is so important for our Dharma practice, you know, because as long as, if we continue to feel like, you know, I'm this independent agent, I'm responsible for my own life, I'm going to do it myself, that creates a very solid sense of I. Okay, and that's precisely the sense of I we're trying to deconstruct. When you do a lot of meditation on the kindness of others, it helps us to see that there's not a solid, permanent I that's there, that's in power. And so it helps on the wisdom side of the path. It also helps on the compassion side of the path, because we realize the kindness of others in sharing all these things with us. Okay, and because, you know, we don't spend our own money, and all the money that's been given to the Abbey comes from donations, then even when the Abbey goes out and buys building supplies, or, you know, gets the satellite connection or whatever it is, when we do get the things that are necessary for the Abbey, we're very aware that it's not our money. You know, that it's money that kind benefactors have given to us. And so we have to be very careful in how we spend the money. You know, we can't just go out and get the first thing we see. You know, we have to look at prices. We have to, you know, shop well and get something that's going to last for a long time. You know, and then we're, you know, there's an incredible responsibility, I think, when you live off. You live due to the kindness of others, okay? So this is a very important part of the training of a monastic lifestyle, is to feel that kindness of others, and then, of course, to make dedication prayers for their benefit. So every lunch, you know, the prayers that we've been doing after lunch are dedication prayers specifically for the people who have offered the food that we've eaten, because we stay alive only through the kindness of the people who've offered the food. We don't go out and buy our own food at the Abbey. Everything we have has been something that's offered. Or if people can't bring the food directly, then they've given the money to the fund that you have. And then people, you know, might do the grocery shopping. But still, the groceries are coming due to the money of people who have offered it. Okay, so it really makes, when you're a monastic, it makes you change your mind, yeah? And there's a, you know, a very special connection, because you realize that you're alive simply because other people want you to be, and because they've given, you know, that they work very hard at their jobs, and through their own generosity, they've given the things that you use. So you don't just use them carelessly and throw the food away or waste stuff or whatever. Yeah? And so similarly, one thing, we were very glad when you had a a garage sale in Coeur d'Alene. And thank you very much, by the way, all of those of you who participated, because we also had some things that we weren't using here that we could donate for the garage sale. And we didn't get a chance to clean out the inside cupboards, but we need to. Okay. And I think there's supposed to be another garage sale. Is there? Yeah? Okay. But we have things to offer for that too. You know, and so I think, you know, that's definitely part of our practice too, that we keep our cupboards from getting too full. When we first moved in the Abbey, you know, so many people brought us sheets and towels, and, you know, just like so many of them. And I was reading the local paper, and there was one family whose house had burned down, and they needed stuff. So I called the paper, and I said, you can come and get the sheets and towels. As it turned out, they never came and got them, but we gave them to the food bank in Old Town, and we had an old freezer, you know, and we gave that, and then, you know, various other things we were able to give away. And so this is just this thing of, you know, simplicity in life. So you need storage, but you only store the things that you are really going to use. You don't just store things just because you have them, or just because you like them, or just because you're attached to them, or whatever. Okay? So this whole thing of really feeling responsible and feeling that interconnectedness, you know? And if I have something and I'm not using it, it needs to go, you know, to somebody else. And so we have a collective area, you know, because people have brought in a lot of clothes for monastics, and so, you know, where we, not these clothes, but like sweaters and t-shirts and things like that. So we have a place where we put that, and then as monastics need things, and they can get the clothes they need from that pile. Okay, so you really feel the interconnectedness. And then another advantage is we learn to differentiate needs from wants, you know, when you have simplicity of lifestyle. Okay, and when you don't just go out and get something the moment the impulse comes in your mind, is you learn to differentiate what is it that's really necessary and what is it that is my greedy mind. And how much is shopping an expression of something else that I'm not dealing with? Okay, because I think, for example, that sometimes we go shopping when we're lonely. Yeah? Or sometimes people go shopping when there's some kind of feeling of like loss or loneliness or not being loved. And so in an attempt to feel that people care for us, because possessions often symbolize care, then we go to the mall and buy something. Okay? Or we might go and buy something out of distraction. Again, because maybe there's some emotional state that's going on. There might be some grief, there might be resentment, but instead of dealing with the emotional state, we go out and buy something to distract ourselves. Okay? So in monastic life, we don't do this. Yeah? So then, whatever the emotional state is, it's there, and, you know, at one time or another, you look at it. You know, and you figure out ways to work with that specific emotional state. Okay, so that can actually be quite an interesting meditation in and of itself. Yeah, or quite an interesting journal keeping activity. You know, when do I go and buy things, and what do I buy, and what's really going on in my mind when I go buy that stuff? And what do I need, and what do I want? Now, or to have a practice that every time you buy something, you give something away. It sounds very good. I wonder if you're going to go home and do that. Everybody, yeah, that's. Are you going to do it? Dare I ask you later if you've done it? You know, or just as a homework assignment. In our practice of cultivating delight in giving, to practice every, you know, once a week to give something away. Or once a day to give something. Make sure you give something, even if it's a cookie, you know. To make sure you give something every day to somebody. Yeah. Can be a very, very interesting practice to do. Even if it's something small, even if it's, you know, 5 minutes of time that you hadn't planned to give, you know, but to really, you know, that's... I can all see us at 10 o'clock at night. Oh, I forgot to give something away. I better, you know, figure out something. Can I give you this before I go to bed? Please? Okay. But very interesting thing to, you know, make part of our Dharma practice. Huh? Okay, so learning to differentiate between needs and wants. Another advantage of the living simply is that we avoid, we tame the mind that wants instant gratification. And that mind's a big problem in our society, and I think that's one of the big, that's the problem with young people these days, you know? They just want instant gratification. And who is it that taught them that? Us. Okay? But, you know, this whole thing of wanting instant gratification and what that does to your mind, you know, and how difficult it becomes to live together with other people when we have that mind that wants instant gratification. Yeah? Big problem. And His Holiness Dalai Lama says that that's one of the biggest difficulties that Westerners have in their Dharma practice, is they want quick results. Because we're so used to, so habituated to, I want and I get. I want and I get. Yeah? And in monastic life, you want and you don't get. You know? And then you go, but you don't understand. We need this. You know? And then you have somebody like me who goes, do we really need that? What's going to happen if we don't get it? You know? Or people come here, you know, the first thing they notice is there's no coffee. Yeah. But, and, you know, some people kind of bring coffee, you know, in their back pocket. And I know about it because they forget it, and I'm the one who finds it. Lying around. Yeah. So first thing, I want coffee. Well, that's very nice, but we don't drink coffee here. Okay? Okay. And we learn to do without, you know, in our shopping. If we run out of things, we wait until the next time shopping is done to get them. Okay? And so, you know, sometimes I'm in the position of being the bad guy. And, but, you know, I think some of you will slowly start filling that role. You know, because this is the agreement of how we live together. You know, it's part of our values. And you can see how it's very directly related to Dharma practice, isn't it? I mean, these practical things, they're not just things that are, you know, chosen randomly. They're all things that have a Dharma value behind them. Okay. And so also instant gratification breeds dissatisfaction. So in living a lifestyle where we don't just go out and get what we want, we get a really good opportunity to look at the dissatisfied mind. And normally we think that that our dissatisfaction, our unhappiness comes because we can't have what we want. So we think the problem is not having the object or the person or whatever it is that we want. But when you live in a monastic situation, you see that the suffering is coming not because of the lack of the object, but because of the wanting and the craving inside of the mind. And that as soon as we're able to let go of the clinging, the suffering stops. Yeah. So as long as the mind is clinging for coffee, as long as the mind wants a blanket that's a certain color, you know, as long as we want our own kind of hand lotion, there's suffering in the mind. You know, and then just through the discipline of the way we live, you know, that we cultivate satisfaction and contentment with what we're giving because we're practicing seeing the kindness of others. Okay? If you really practice seeing the kindness of others, there's no dissatisfaction in the mind. But it takes time to rehabituate the mind in that way because we're very used to practicing dissatisfaction. Yeah? And the blanket's too scratchy. And the, you know, the rug isn't the color that I like. And the, you know, whatever it is, okay, the lampshade is, you know, ugly. And just learning, okay, you know, not getting what I want, this suffering comes because of my mind, not because of not getting the lampshade and the blanket and the, you know, I need a certain kind of toothbrush. You know? I mean, I'm using silly examples, but watch the mind. Watch our mind. Yeah? I need a certain kind of sweater. Okay. Well, you make do with the kind of sweater that's there. Yeah? And as it becomes part of your practice, and you begin to see that the suffering is caused not by the lack of the object, but because of the mind that is wanting. So you train yourself to drop that mind, that wanting, needing mind, and instead to say, wow, look what I do have. I got a sweater, you know. It's not exactly the kind of sweater I would have chosen if I had gone out and bought something, but somebody gave this to me out of their affection and care and kindness, and it's going to keep me warm, and I'm very, very grateful. So you train the mind that way. And it's a very, very good mind training, extremely effective mind training. Okay? It's the same thing with robes. I mean, I would not, this is not my favorite color, let me tell you. Okay? When people tell me that, you know, sometimes I'm traveling somewhere and they'll go, I really like your outfit. I go, you do? I don't like this color, you know, and I don't like the style, and I don't like, you know, there's no pocket. But, you know, you wear it. Okay, I mean, I've slightly redesigned it because of practical concerns, but, you know, you learn. Yeah, you cultivate gratitude for what other people give. Also, another advantage to simplicity of lifestyle is we have fewer problems, because the more things you have, the more things you have to protect, and the more things you have to fix when they break. Okay, fewer things you have, you know, fewer things that break. Okay. If you don't own a car, you don't have car problem hell. It's one of those hell realms next to a beach. You know. If you don't have a computer, you don't get reborn in computer hell. You know, I happen to have several rebirths in that one. Okay? But, you know, there's something to be said for having few possessions, because then there's less that breaks. Okay? And when you do have things, then you have a good opportunity to practice patience for those things that are broken. Okay? So, and also less to protect. You don't have, you're not so afraid of people stealing things. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I noticed that, you know, on our gate, because you'll notice around the house we have little verses taken from the 37 practices. A bodhisattva's posted around the house. And the one on the gate I thought was very timely. It's about...
all your possessions are half of the soul.
Yeah.
Give all of your possessions, body, all your merits to a person.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was a very, very wise one to put right on the gate, you know, because it reminds us. Yeah. Somebody steals your stuff, you make offering. Okay, and also just to see that you know, when you have a lot of stuff, then you need a burglar alarm system. Yeah? And, you know, I travel a lot, and I'm always a little bit, I'm more scared when I live in a house with a burglar alarm system, because one time I was staying at my parents' house and they have an alarm system, and I opened the door in the morning and the whole alarm went off, you know, and I get up before the rest of the family and, you know, and it was like all of a sudden, it was like I jumped out of my skin almost. So I'm quite afraid of doing that again accidentally, or staying at somebody's house when they have a burglar alarm, you know. But if you have more possessions, then you need alarm, don't you? Okay, so you begin to also see that contentment is the real richness in life. Okay, it sounds like a good value, but really to spend time, you know, meditating on that. Contentment is the real richness. We learn to share, and so this whole thing of giving away what we don't use. My basic standard is if I haven't used it in a year, I should give it away, unless it's something that is very difficult to get, and I have to keep it, you know, until the one I have now is raised. Is used up, okay? So, for example, maroon sweaters. Yeah, they aren't always easy to get. So I might have, you know, a maroon sweater in my drawer that I don't use until the one that I'm wearing is in tatters, and then I'll start to use that, okay? But other than that, you know, I think if we've gone a whole year and we haven't used something, it's time to give it away. We've gone through all four seasons, you know? Yeah. And that's the thing that's nice in a monastic setting, is if you've gone for a year and you haven't used it, it can go in the community area for community coats or community clothes or, you know, whatever. And then other people can use it. Or if, you know, your thing wears out and you need it, it's still there, you can go and get it. Okay. So it, by living a lifestyle with simplicity, you really reduce this thought of mine, okay? And so again, it makes it, by reducing the thought of mine, it makes living so much simpler, because we're not always, you know, this is mine, this is yours, and mine, and me, okay? Another very practical advantage is if you live a simple lifestyle, there's less clutter. Yeah, because people's houses are so cluttered nowadays, you know? I mean, just clutter all over. And if we, you know, really go back and we give things away, you know, or we get rid of all of our little memorabilia, I wouldn't be a very good sales lady for an office. I can't even say the word. But, you know, you get rid of it, there's so much less clutter in the house, you know, and the clutter in the house makes the mind cluttered, doesn't it? Because we have so much sensory stimulation, because all the different things we see and all the different things we have to think about, and it makes the mind cluttered. So less cluttered environment, less cluttered mind. Okay, so many, many kinds of advantages to a certain simplicity in lifestyle. Okay, so that's what we practice here at the Abbey, and sometimes we slip up and then we rein ourselves in, you know, and we remind ourselves about this whole thing. I know for me, you know, I mean, just all these small things that you see that you have to practice with, okay, because one thing as a monastic is that you like certain kind of teacups. Okay, isn't it? You know, I mean, especially Tibetan tradition, you know, tea is like the staple, you know, everybody drinks tea. So, you know, your mind has a certain preference for a certain kind of teacup, and that isn't the kind of teacup that people have offered. You know, they offer another kind of teacup because you want one that's big and with a lid. I'm telling you now. We all want, you know. the big, the lid, you know, blah, 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 you know. And then people give you teacups without lids, they give you small things, they give you, you know, all this stuff. And you just, you learn to practice contentment with the kind of teacup that you get. So, but it's so interesting because you watch the mind and you see, wow, look at how I spend my mental energy, you know. I spend my mental energy having so many preferences about the kind of teacup I'm going to use, as if that's going to make me ultimately happy. Yeah? And then you say, okay, got to let go of that one. You know, stop spending the mental energy on that kind of, you know, that kind of thing. Or people also learn the simplicity of lifestyle here, you know, that we wear plain clothes, you know, not with patterns and this and that and the other thing. And it's a big thing for people when they come to stay here long term to begin to switch, because we're so used to, you know, getting stuff with, you know, trim and pattern and nice and flashy and whatever. Yeah. I wonder sometimes people have to go out and buy new clothes so they can come to the Abbey. They don't have anything that's, you know. Yeah, I mean, for visitors and guests, it's a whole different ballgame, you know, but for the people who live here, it's different. Okay.